ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So this morning, we're going to be reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 2, Text 13 and 14. But just let me say a few words before we start. One thing is that my wife offers her regrets for not being able to be here this morning. Today, Satchinandan Swami is coming to our house, and so she's engaged in cleaning the house and cooking, which is a challenge on Ekadasi. But she's doing that, and it's not, as Kalakanta said to me, that she would rather go to hear a sannyasi from Germany than her own husband give class. She anticipated that. So I want to make sure that I represent her correctly here today. But I think you all are aware of the seminar classes that Satchinanda Swami has been giving out in Alachua. And this morning we're going to talk a little bit about some of the things he was discussing last evening as we study the Srimad Bhagavatam verses we have before us today. So, we have text number 13 and 14 of the second chapter of the first canto. I'll just chant the Sanskrit. You can repeat. Atak Pumbir Duja Shrestha Varnashrama Vibhagasa Svanustitasya dharmasya Samsidhir harito shanam Atak pumbir duja shrestha Varnashrama vibhagasa Svanustitasya dharmasya Samsidhir harito shanam Please chant. Atak bumbir dvija shrestha Varnashrama vibhagasa Svanustitasya dharmasya Samsidhir haritoshanam Tak bumbir duja shrestha Varnashrama vibhagasaha Svanustitasya dharmasya Samsidhir haritoshanam Gumbir duja shrestha Vibhashrama vibhagasaha Svanustitasya dharmasya Samsidhir haritoshanam Word meanings atas, so, pumbir, by the human being, dvija shrestha, O best among the twice born, Varna Ashrama, the institution of four castes and four orders of life, Vibhagasaha, by the division of Svanustitasya, of one's own prescribed duties, Dharmasya, occupational, Samsidhi, the highest perfection, Hari, the personality of Godhead, Toshanam, pleasing. Translation, O best among the twice born, it is therefore concluded that the highest perfection one can achieve by discharging the duties prescribed for one's own occupation according to caste divisions and orders of life is to please the personality of Godhead. So, Shruti Sagar, what do you want
to start? Human society all over the world is divided into four castes and four orders of life. The four castes are the intelligent caste, the martial caste, the productive caste, and the laborer caste. These castes are classified in terms of one's work and qualification and not by birth. Then again, there are four orders of life, namely the student life, the householder's life, the retired, and a devotional life. In the best interest of human society, there must be such divisions of life. Otherwise, no social institution can grow in a healthy state. And in each and every one of the above-mentioned divisions of life, the aim must be to please the supreme authority of the personality of Godhead.
This institutional function of human society is known as the system of Varnashram Dhamma, which is quite natural for a civilized life. The Varnashram institution is constructed to enable one to realize the absolute truth. It is not for artificial domination of one division or over another. When the aim of life, i.e., Indriya Priti or sense gratification, when the aim of life, i.e., realization of the absolute truth, is missed by too much attachment for Indriya Priti or sense gratification, as already discussed here and before, the institution of Varnashram is utilized by selfish men to pose an artificial predominance over the weaker section. In the Kali Yuga or in the age of quarrel, the artificial predominance is already current, but the saner section of people know it well, that the divisions of castes and orders of life are meant for smooth social intercourse and high thinking, self-realization, and not for any other purpose.
Herein, the statement of Bhagavatam is that the highest aim of life, or the highest perfection of the institution of the Varnashram Dharma, is to cooperate jointly for the satisfaction of the Supreme Lord. This is also confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita.
Okay, thank you. Let me just read the translation to text 14. We'll save the purport for a little later in the class. A translation, therefore, with one pointed attention, one should constantly hear about, glorify, remember, and worship the personality of Godhead, who is the protector of the devotees. So as I mentioned, Sachinanda Swami is giving this seminar on, he calls it Temple of the Heart. And he's giving the lectures, a series of lectures, talking basically about the five main or most potent items of devotional service. That wasn't completely clear to me for the first couple of lectures, but then I started to catch on what he was doing. Because he talked about five roads or steps that we would go on to reaching and being able to access the temple of the heart. And he began by talking about devotee association, how important that was. And then he talked about the holy name. Now, after he finished talking about the holy name, I realized, well, wait a minute, this is going down a list that is well known. Who knows where that list comes from, the five most potent items of devotional service. Yes? Nectar of devotion, yes, very good. Nectar of devotion lists 64 items of devotional service, five of which are the most potent. They are association with devotees, chanting the holy name of the Lord, hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, deity worship, and living in a holy place, such as Vrindavan, Mathura, Krishna House, Sri Mayapur Dham. Yes, across the street too, as long as we make our own home a temple. And that's done very nicely. I think Kalakantapu wrote an article years ago for a local paper about temple home altars or something, right? The origin of it was a Christian thing, but, you know, when they didn't know what they had when they talked about home altars with the devotee community, because so many wonderful altars around. So So these five items are the most potent in devotional service. And because the lecture last night focused on hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, I thought that I would try to share some of the things that he spoke about there with you this morning. He talked about a method of approaching Srimad Bhagavatam that's found in the Upanishads, the Upanishadic tradition. I guess it's a traditional way in which scholars study any scripture. And it has four aspects. Reading, reflecting, applying, and praying. So these four steps can be, should be part of any study of the scripture. Reading, reflecting, applying, and praying. Can anybody tell me or paraphrase for me what text 13 said? Don't look at the book. Without looking at the books, can someone paraphrase for that? Yes, Gopal? Yes, the occupational duties of man is to please the Supreme Personality of God. Is that all it said? Yes? Okay. So we have obligations to perform by our... Okay, and all the four varnas and ashrams, pleasing the Supreme Lord is what should be done. Anything else anybody remembers from the verse? Yes. We should follow the, according to our tendency, not our birth. Okay. Okay. To please Krishna as a purpose and for smooth social intercourse. Very good. I think that's good. A lot of times, and even happened last night, there was a verse put up on the board and there was a room full of hundreds of devotees, and we read the verse, and then just a couple of minutes later, the Maharaj asked, can someone tell me what we just read? And nobody could really say, you know, because, and it happens a lot when we read, that we read it, but we don't really absorb what's being said. And so that was the point he made by that exercise. But I think that you're more advanced here in Gainesville, because we got some good responses. But if you notice something about the responses that we did get, they reflected the purport a lot. They reflected the purport a lot. I mean, that, like, there was emphasis on that we should do this. Let's see, where is it? With the aim to please the Supreme Lord. So that's in the verse, and it's also in the purport. Specific interests, specific mention of the different occupations and castes as a birth are both in the purport and in the verse. And so, Srila Prabhupada, by giving us these purports, he's helping us do these four things in study of Srimad Bhagavatam. We read, and then we reflect. And Prabhupada's purports are actually his reflections on the verse and the reflections of the previous acharyas that he's following in giving his giving us his purports. And so reading and reflecting, and then applying. Applying, the reason why I'm giving the class on this subject matter this morning, because I thought, well, I should do what I heard last night, which is apply. So he talked about these four things, and one of them being applying. So I thought, well, I should, if I'm going to give a class, then I should also apply that to what I'm doing, what I learned last night. So we're going to try to do some of these steps today. Now, we've read, and some of you have shared your reflections. But I'd like to take a look, a close look at the purport and the verse, purport or the verse, and reflect on it a little bit so that it really sinks into our consciousness. For me, when I read the purport, actually, Shruti Sagar, who was reading, and he said that, he mentioned that human society all over the world is divided into four castes and four orders of life. And then Prabhupada said the four castes are the intelligent caste, the martial class, the productive caste, labor caste. The word caste was really, really struck me. And it struck me because it kind of a negative connotation, right? I mean, the caste system. I mean, what have you heard about India? You know, we've heard the caste system, and it's something that's not good. It's oppressive or something like that. And so when I first read this purport, in reflecting upon it, I think, well, is that what Krishna consciousness is all about? You know, it's just like a caste system or something. Does anybody else get that kind of impression when that word is there? When you got that impression too? Yeah. Okay. Well, maybe. What about somebody from India? Does it strike you? I mean, Americans may feel a certain way about that, given our conditioning. Anyone from India react differently? Let me get.
Actually, my father used to tell me from young that caste system by birth is a perverted social structure, social thing right now. It's actually by qualification, not by birth. So he used to tell me since I was young. So
reading that word sort of reaffirms good training you had in your family and things like that, you know, understanding. Uh-huh. That's good. Anybody else have any reflections on what those words mean? Or anything? I mean, what do the first few lines of Prabhupada's purport here to text 13 mean to you? What stands out to you when you think about it? Somebody else? Okay. Anybody else? Questions too? Okay. Anybody have a reflection on the first sections of the purport? Gopal?
Just simple, what was already said. I know that's how most people view the caste system, is that it's oppressive or whatever. I know that's how most people view it, especially Westerners.
We'll take the questions now. Andrew, you had a question? Somebody else? Okay, Shruti.
I was just saying how Prabhupada is saying that he's mentioning how human society all over the world is divided. He's actually saying, it is just interesting that Prabhupada is saying, and we can also see that there's vaguely, there's distribution is everywhere. So that came out when I was reading, like, yeah, and the orders of life also, it is vaguely just everywhere we can see.
Yeah, that's very good. That's a very important part of the purport here that Prabhupada's saying, is that this is not something that's Hindu or Indian or American or anything else. It's a universal principle. And so we're getting that from Prabhupada's purport, that again, he's reaffirming what he's giving us, the science of Krishna consciousness, by saying something. If you observe, you can see this everywhere. That's very good. So we had a couple questions here.
When it says, like, that the caste isn't by birth, it's by occupation, so you choose your caste, pretty much. Is that, like...
Do we choose our caste? Anybody? You have an answer? Do you mind?
According to my opinion, it's your inclination. It's you are inclined to what? And that defines your caste. Means, if you are very intelligent, means it lies in your intelligent category. If you are not very much intelligent, but you are physically very strong, then you lies in the labor category. So according to me, it is your inclination and what God has given to you.
What if you're like, I don't know, like now you're so... Like, okay, you want to do something, but this is your inclination, but how do you know that's really what you're supposed to do instead of just you wanting to do that and not really seeing what Krishna wants you to do? You know, like maybe a service or something that you really want to do and that's your inclination, but it's not really your inclination, you're just attached to it or something, like, you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
What if you want to go against your nature so much that even if you are like that strong person but you still want to like study and become a philosopher or something, like what if that's such a strong desire? Like just like if a man is born a man but he wants to be a woman, he'll like start dressing up like a lady and stuff because he feels like, yeah, well, I was born a man, but like I feel like I'm a lady.
Yeah, I think that it's a struggle that we go through, right? Because maybe it's not so clear what is our inclination, what am I actually meant to do. But what does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita in this regard? What does Krishna say? Because we have the same kind of situation, don't we? We have Arjuna. He was a warrior by birth, by training, everything. But then all of a sudden he said, well, like, I don't want to fight. I want to go to the woods, to the forest, and be like a hermit. So what did Krishna say?
Krishna said that if you don't fight for me, you'll still fight because it's your nature. But it's better that you fight for me than, you know, fight not for me.
This is good because, again, we're reflecting on the purport to get a deeper meaning. So when we go back to this verse in the future, we'll have some deeper understanding. I think that what Krishna says to Arjuna is obviously the absolute truth. And the way we can understand is that it'll come out over time. Especially when we're young, it's hard to get a grasp on it because we don't have a whole view of our life. We don't have a view of what circumstances may come. And so therefore, in addition to there being these four orders and castes of life, another thing that's not specifically mentioned but we can understand from this is that they're elders. And elders can help us, guide us, and direct us in understanding what our varna is. And so that's another sort of a hidden thing that we get out of this coming from the questions. Now, we had a question back here again. Let's get Olivia. Yeah.
I was given some guidance that's kind of related to Andrea's question, and I was just told basically that Krishna puts these desires within our heart. Like, if you feel I'm very inclined to, like, be a teacher, or I'm very to be, you know, a mother, or to a business person, whatever it is, like, Krishna puts these desires in our hearts, and I think that also relates to the praying. If we just pray to him, like, Krishna, is this something that I'm just temporarily feeling, you know, like I'm getting some external influence, or I'm just maybe like being whimsical, or I'm overthinking things, or is this like a desire that's come, that you put in my heart? So I think reflecting on that, like, that's really helped me clarify, like, which desires for me are, should I follow, and which ones are just kind of like temporary a little. And my question is, in the purport it says the four divisions, student, householders, retired, and devotional. So I was like, wait, why is devotional? In the purport, in the fifth sentence. So I was just a little confused why devotional is, like, separated from the other three.
Very good observation. I think I have a response to that. Why is devotional sort of separated out from those things? Yes?
Well, I think that in all those different ashrams, life is devotional. Life is intended to be devotional. But in the particularly like in the householder life, or in even the vanaprastha life, you have duties. You have specific duties, like material duties and things. But in the, once you've retired from that and taken, I'm assuming that devotional life refers to sannyas, like you've renounced everything, so you have no other duties. You're not concentrating on anything besides your Krishna consciousness. You have no real material attachments, yeah.
So, like, purely devotional?
That's just my understanding of it.
I think that's good understanding, yes. When we come to that stage of life, all other duties are reduced, and we just focus exclusively on devotion to the Lord. But it's a good question because it comes up that Prabhupada, in a sense, emphasizes for us what we should reflect on by making the italicized phrase, the aim is to please the supreme authority, Well, let's just start the whole sentence. And in each and every one of the above-mentioned divisions of life, the aim is to please the supreme authority of the personality of Godhead. So if that's the case, then why devotional just at the end? I think it's a valid question that comes from reflecting on the purport. But let's take a look at the different occupations that are there and how they may be applied to this principle of devotion that Prabhupada gives us in all the ashrams. Let's take the example of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur was, obviously he was a very learned person, Brahmin, but he was also a very good manager. A very good manager as well. Indeed, if we look at how he applied in his occupation, how he applied his management skills in his occupation to deity worship, for instance, we see that he was the magistrate in Puri and therefore in charge of the Jagannath Temple. And so what did he do when he was in charge of the Jagannath Temple? Do we read about Bhaktivinoda Thakur doing the puja and, you know, taking part in all the things that the Brahmins generally do there in Puri? Has anybody, I mean, I haven't read that. Has anybody ever read that in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's life? No, Bhaktivinoda Thakur was allowed to go in. He was a magistrate. And the caste system at that time did allow him to go in, or it didn't allow others to go in. But yeah, he went in, but his management ability in the deity worship was shown in his regulating the times for the offerings, making sure that the temple functioned well. I can imagine that there were accounting things that he also instituted to make the temple more accountable. And so all of that is deity worship, but it's not the type of deity worship that involved, that we might think that a Brahmin does, but more like a Kshatriya or something like that, right? He had that position, like a Kshatriya, a manager, or administrator. And he used that in devotion to Krishna by making sure the temple was well managed. And so that's an example about how you can apply that devotion that Amrita Kelly was talking about in different varnas or ashrams. How, as Prabhupada says, that's the aim, to please the supreme authority, the personality of Godhead, no matter where we're situated in the varna ashram system. Okay, anybody have any questions about that? Or any other comments or reflections at this point in time? Yes?
I think it's interesting. My understanding is that Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he wasn't born into a Vaishnava family, right? I mean, and it wasn't, would it be considered was he really born, he's a Brahmin, but was he really, I don't think he was born into a Brahmin family. I mean, that's my understanding, because didn't they eat, they ate like lamb and stuff like this. And
more like a Vaishya caste. He was
born into a very well-to-do family. Yeah, and he wrote about all the Brahmins in his village being very plump and prosperous.
So later he manifested the qualities of the greatest Brahmin by all the writing and devotion he exhibited. And so that's another good thing about understanding the caste system, that it's not as limiting or rigid as those words, that caste, you know, that gives us a very rigid idea. It's not as rigid. Let's see. Go here.
I just wanted to make a comment on Andrea's initial question. The traditionally, the, as Prabhupada pointed out, the student life, or the brahmachari life, they would go to what is called the gurukul, the teacher's school. And there, you know, over time, the teacher would
get to know the student, the nature of the student, and then, you know, then he would be directed appropriately like that. That's the Gurukul system. So one would be appropriately engaged by his nature, you know, when he grows up. But also I know when I was in school, even in high school, we had a system where, because the tendency was, you know, after people graduate from high school, they go to college, you know, they take courses, and after 2 or 3 years of, you know, after 3 years, they've tried like 4 or 5 courses, you know, moving from medicine to engineering to all these different. So they instituted a system where we had a guidance counselor at school, where you would take certain tests, and then they would check you out, and, you know, your inclinations like that, and then they would recommend certain careers for you. Even when you went to college, they also had the same system where you would, you know, you would write tests, and then based on the results of your tests, you would have an interview with certain professors, and then they would tell you, actually, we think you have these strong points and these weaknesses, and therefore it's better if you went this way. So, like, I mean, I was just bringing up the point that you'd made initially, that guidance actually helps, brings out, you know, the proper direction for us.
I was wondering if all the children at Gurukula mixed with each other, like, they weren't discriminated by caste or anything, they were all just, like, looked as children, and then they learned their caste over time.
If we look at Krishna's Leela, we see that Krishna, he was a Kshatriya, at least he was a Kshatriya, right? His father, Vasudeva, sent him there, they're all Kshatriyas, sent him to the Gurukul land. Who did he meet there who became his close friend? Sudama was a Brahmin. So they were together, Sudama and Krishna. But I do think that there is a stage when you are more directed towards your inclination. And we see this in the lives of the Pandavas. When the Pandavas were trained, Pandavas and the Kauravas together, there were like hundreds of them, and they were all trained together. And the point is made there that their teacher, Dronacharya, was a Brahmin. And he was actually criticized for acting like a Kshatriya at times, and not just teaching Kshatriya arts, but acting in the role of a Kshatriya. So my impression of his school was that it was all just sons of kings. There's actually the story about Nishada, in the forest they went. He wasn't a Kshatriya, at least not high-class Kshatriya. And he wanted to be Dronacharya's student, but he was not allowed to be his student. That was a bit of the oppression. Who was talking about oppression? Somebody mentioned oppression. Oh, okay. Yeah, well, there was some oppression there with the Nishada. He was Nishada prince. He wasn't allowed to associate with others, although he was obviously a Kshatriya as well, but maybe not a high class. So there was that kind of discrimination there. Let's go here.
Just a small comment about, you were talking about Bhaktivinoda Thakur and the caste system, but I was thinking that, you know, a Vaishnava automatically can do all things. Like, they can be Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, acting Sudra way, but in the different orders, the Vaishnava is actually above those orders. So I think in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's instance, he did that as well.
Very good. Additional reflections on this whole idea of the caste system and how it relates to Vaishnavas. Vaishnavas are liberated souls. They're beyond the ordinary distinctions of four spiritual orders of life and the four working orders of life. And we should always remember that, because sometimes in our duties, again, applying, let's go to the step of applying. If we're going to apply this understanding that we as devotees of the Lord, as Vaishnavas devotees of the Lord, are liberated from the mundane varnashram system, then we shouldn't complain. I'm a Brahmin. Why are you asking me to clean the floor? Or book distribution is a Vaishya activity. these kind of things are not the correct understanding of the position of a Vaishnava. The Vaishnava is above these things. And again, we need to apply that because we will be tested in that way. We'll be tested in many ways. Actually, there are a couple of tests, cases that I wanted to bring up to you from the Mahabharata. Because these are cases where these two people I'm going to mention were acting according to their varna. They're acting according to their varna, but they were acting incorrectly in what they did and the conclusions they made. And the first story has to do with, you remember that Brahmin that I was telling you about, I think it was last week, Kaushika, and he went to meet the butcher, and the butcher instructed him? Okay, his story didn't end there. There's more about him. And obviously he was a Brahmana. But let me read to you a situation that came up where he was acting like a Brahmana and standing on the principles of a Brahmana. One of the principles of Brahmana is truthfulness, right? Truth in the Bhagavad Gita says. I think that's the very first one that's mentioned, isn't it? Satyam, it's the first one. Okay, so let's see what this Brahmana, Kaushika, did and see where he might have gone wrong. A hermit, Kaushika by name, once took a vow of telling the truth throughout his life. One day he faced the following dilemma. Some bandits were chasing several travelers with the intention of killing them. Kaushika was sitting nearby at the crossroad. The travelers passed by and requested him not to show the miscreants which way they had fled. Kaushika did not answer. Soon the bandits arrived, and knowing that the hermit would not lie, asked him about the travelers. And Kaushika told the truth. As a result, the travelers were caught and killed. So, did he do the right thing or not? In terms of applying his brahminical nature, applying what he read about the qualities of a Brahmin, did he do the right thing or not? Couldn't he just not answer? Well, okay, that's a valid question. Could he just not answer? Would that be the correct thing for him to do as a Brahmin?
What was the purpose of the vow? If truthfulness is always should be a virtue of a Brahmana, then there's no need for taking a vow. He should just always tell the truth. So in that case, I think it's like, even though a Brahmana should always tell the truth, if it's like a life or death situation, I don't know.
So there's some purpose to be fulfilled by these qualities, not just the quality itself. There's some purpose to be fulfilled. Very good. Anything else on opinions about Kaushika before we found out what actually happened to him?
It was bad discrimination. And I took a philosophy course years ago. One of the things that was presented was it's okay to tell a lie if it does less harm to more people than telling the truth. I'm not saying I took that, but that's something that...
Right, well, there's all kinds of ways of determining what's best to do.
Sort of going off what Gopal Prabhu said, but it seems that in this situation, he was actually more concerned about his own reputation than even the lives of other people. Otherwise, what's the point in preserving the vow? And so I don't think that's very brahminical at all, but that choice.
Yeah, if we look in the purport, we see that, don't we? We see that in Prabhupada's purport here today, because he says that what happens in a caste system gone wrong is that it's not for artificial domination of one division over another. When the aim of life, i.e. realization of the Absolute Truth, is missed by too much attachment for indriya priti or sense gratification, as is already described here before, the institution is utilized by selfish men to pose an artificial predominance over the weaker section. So this is what Amrita Kaili is saying, that it became so degraded in Kaushika's mind that I'm a Brahmin, that I'm going to tell the truth, that it became sense gratification. It's for him only. But the aim is supposed to be what? To please the supreme authority, Krishna. So Kaushika was wrong, and I've heard different versions of this, the ending of Kaushika, from that Krishna killed him himself. No, wait a minute, that wasn't Krishna killed him himself. That was actually the Nishada prince that tried to have Dronacharya as his teacher. But what happened here was, it says that as a result, the travelers were caught and killed. Kaushika did not reach heaven after his death, which was his much coveted reward, just because of this act of cruelty. So he was acting as a Brahmin, trying to apply the principles of a Brahmin, trying to apply what he read, but he got it wrong, and therefore he missed the entire goal. Yes.
I just wanted to refer to verse, I think, chapter 13 of the Bhagavad Gita, verse number 8 to 12, where they describe all the qualities that a devotee has. And Prabhupada very clearly mentions in the purport, just as you said, that none of these qualities are useful unless you can develop, unless you're performing devotional service for the Lord.
So let's take a look at another example here. This is from the Mahabharata also. And it may be a little bit more challenging to us because it involves a devotee of the Lord, a great devotee of the Lord that we're all familiar with. Yudhisthira has a lot of stories too, but we're going to focus on Arjuna at this point, okay? Arjuna. One day in a battle, Karna was fighting very, very valiantly. So valiantly that he was killing all the soldiers, and he actually drove Yudhisthira from the battle, very severely beating him and humiliating him. So that when Yudhisthira came back to the camp, he was frustrated and angry. And in that state, he spoke to Arjuna, who was supposed to be the big hero, the savior, the lead warrior of the Pandavas. He spoke to him. He said that Yudhisthira flared up in anger and told Arjuna that all his boastfulness about being the finest archer in the world was a lot of nonsense because the war was dragging on. He reminded Arjuna that the latter claimed to be capable of conquering everybody and thus end the war within a few days. In rage, he not only insulted Arjuna, but he also slighted the Gandiva bow, the most precious possession of this valiant warrior. The bow was a gift to Arjuna from Agni, the fire god. He held it so dear to his heart that he had promised to kill anyone who would ever speak ill of Gandiva. Hence, Yudhisthira's words put Arjuna in a very difficult situation. Either he would have to kill his venerated elder brother or break his promise. So, what should Arjuna do? How should he apply the teachings he had heard from Krishna and Bhagavad Gita to this kind of situation? Gopal. Is a good one to start us off in our discussion.
From what I know, he probably used proper discrimination. But you were talking earlier about, you know, don't ask me to clean the floor, I'm a Brahmin. I read or heard that if a Brahmin sees a situation as unbrahminical and he doesn't do something to correct it, that's non-brahminical.
Yes.
Well, I know the answer, but I'm not going to say it. It's the same situation where Ashwatthama was caught, you know, after having run away, he was caught, and then he was brought back before Draupadi, and it was a question of kill him. You know, one group was saying kill him, and the other one says don't kill him. So they had to come up with a solution. So it's a kind of a similar situation here.
Yeah, these are real. That's why these four steps are there for Shastra. Shastra is not just meant for an academic study. It's meant to be applied in our life. So we have to read or hear. We have to reflect on it. And we have to apply it. And so these are cases where, how do you apply it? Because there are dilemmas that are going to come up. So how do we apply it? Anybody have any idea how we apply Kshatriya Dharma here in this situation with Arjuna? Should he kill his brother or should he break his promise? Anybody have any suggestions? Yes.
I'm not sure much about it, but what I, from the little bit that you told me, I think maybe the right thing would be to tell his elder brother that that's what his vow was, but for the greater good, because he was supposedly to be the king, and he was a nice person, so he would be a good king and good for the kingdom and good for the people. So for the greater good, he should not harm him, and also because he is his respectable brother, but he should tell him that that's what my vow is, and this is something I don't approve of, and I think you did something wrong.
Discussion, conversation about it, talk about it. That's good. Yes. Anybody else? I like that response. Anybody have any? Okay. What do you think happened here? Krishna was there, so he must have done something.
Doesn't he end up doing something that is equal to killing him or something? Like insult? He insults him or something? Or because I know like there's a story where they cut someone's hair, which was the same as like. So doesn't he do something the same? Like, doesn't he like insult Yudhisthira or like, or something like that?
Since we came back, let's get the story. He knows the answer. Yeah.
Well, he did what you did. Krishna said, well, actually, another way of killing somebody is to actually kind of insult him. So he told Yudhisthira, you are such a rascal. You're supposed to be an older brother and lead by example. You know, you sold your wife in in gambling matches. So he degraded him in that way, and that was as good as killing him.
So these things, as I said, illustrate how we're going to apply the teachings that we learn. And that's a very, very essential if we're actually going to understand them. Now, if we can't apply them, we can't understand them, then we go to the fourth step, which is prayer. And we pray to our Guru, we pray to Supreme Lord, to give us some understanding how best to apply these teachings, how best to remember these teachings. Now, I just want to end with how we're sort of rewarded. Of course, we don't do these things to be rewarded, but when we're presented with a dilemma, and what is our duty? We are rewarded in different ways if we're aware of that. And I want to tell you a personal story about myself and how I felt rewarded when I did the right thing. The right thing was coming here for class today, rather than saying, "Well, I gotta go because I can't come, and I want to go hear Satchinandan Swami, and you know, and that's more important to me." That's something that I want to do. My duty to the devotees there is not as important. So that was a struggle that I went through. Not a very great struggle, because I feel proud of myself that I did firmly stand on my duty coming here. But I was rewarded in different ways, and very subtle ways, but meaningful ways. And that was just by being greeted by various devotees here with a Hare Krishna or thank you for coming and things like that, that said to me that Krishna understood what was going on in my mind, in my heart, and therefore by making a choice to come and do my duty, then getting some appreciation of that sacrifice from all of you immediately told me that yes, well, Krishna is saying yes, you made the right decision to do your duty, and even if it was difficult, it was worth it. And I think that's kind of reciprocation that we can look from Krishna when we're faced with how to apply his teachings in our life. If we apply them faithfully, then we'll get reciprocation from Krishna and we'll feel the type of satisfaction that Satchinanda Swami's talking about when he's in his seminar, when he's talking about going to the temple of the heart, being able to access the temple of the heart. When you do that, then you feel safety, security, satisfaction. You actually begin to feel love of Krishna by doing that. So I want to thank all of you for giving me the opportunity to experience this type of a lesson in my own life. So. Any other questions, points, reflections anybody has before they bring out the prasadam today? Question? Yes.
So I'll ask you one question, one dilemma. What it's normally, I think many devotees in Krishna consciousness have, like, oh, they think like, oh, I have to do my homework, assignment, project, or something, some work, which maybe can be postponed, maybe. And then there is this nice event in the temple, Satyananda Maharaj is there, and I really want to hear, this is my service to Maharaj by hearing. This is the dilemma we have like every day.